of times, through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36? We went our separate ways. You fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you don't parry. Yo, baby, what's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers. They call it class war, I call it co-conspirators. Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone. You watched in awe at the red, white, and blue on the 4th of July. While those fireworks were exploding, I was burning that fucker and swinging my black flag high, eating the peanuts that the parties have tossed you in the backseat of your father's new Ford. You believe in the ballot, you believe in reform, you have faith in the elephant and jackass. And to you, solidarity's a four-letter word. We're all hypocrites, but you're a patriot. You thought I was only joking when I screamed kill Whitey at the top of my lungs, at the cops in their cars and the men in their suits. No, I won't take your hand and marry the state. Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone.
9.3 billion. That's how much the Olympics is costing the taxpayer. Nevertheless, the Olympics mayhem is upon us. Everywhere you turn, in London we have been bombarded. Olympics paraphernalia all over the trains and buses, and they have the cheek to carry out raids on graffiti artists across London to sanitise the city for our sake. Today's guests can talk more about the changing face of the city due to the Games. In the studio, we have author of Ground Control, Anna Minton. She was former staff writer of the Financial Times and writes regularly for The Guardian. Hi, Anna. Pleased to have you on the show.
Hi. Thanks for asking me.
No problem. I'm really looking forward to this. So let's fire off. People often say, stop being so grumpy as it's just a sports event. People don't like to think that it's a political issue. But what is the role of the Olympics in the privatisation and militarisation of London?
Well, that's a big question. There's lots of angles that I can take there. The role of the Olympics in the privatisation and militarisation of London. Well, let's take the militarisation first. I mean, I think we couldn't have any clearer example than the 3,000 plus now, I think, soldiers on the streets. I don't have the exact figures.
Something like that.
But we really do have a huge amount of military personnel who've been called in to replace the fill in for the shambles created by the failure of G4S to meet their contractual obligations to the government. The thing with Olympics always you find is that actually security is always really ramped up in advance of the Games. And then it's a question of the legacy, this much talked about legacy. What's going to be the security legacy after the Games? What you've always found in past Olympics is that these security innovations which are introduced are not temporary. They're not just for the duration of the Games. They're actually an opportunity to trial various security technologies, and then they become part of the landscape, the urban landscape thereafter. So in Tokyo, I think in 1964, I think that was actually the first use of private guards, private security. And then they remained in Tokyo thereafter. The thing that had concerned me when I first started looking into the Olympics was the use of drones, the unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, they're called, which are used in Iraq and in Afghanistan. They've been modified now for civilian purposes, and they already fly over parts of the UK. These are standard practice now for the Olympic policing. They're going to be flying over Stratford. They probably already are. And actually, you know, I think we can be almost certain that they're going to stay in London after the Games. Now, we've seen all these eye-catching other extreme military interventions, such as the surface-to-air missiles on top of neighbouring residential buildings. I don't think those will stay. I think those are sort of extreme, sort of, you know, eye-catching, sort of London means business security innovations. But things like the drones, the less talked about military hardware aspects of the security operation will stay. But I think what's been very, very interesting here, obviously, is what's happened with G4S, because this really was supposed to be the opportunity to rival all opportunities for the private security industry to show what it was made of, to showcase to the world really what it could do. And G4S had this enormous contract to deliver, and actually it's completely fallen apart. So, you know, there's a real mix there with the militarisation of London in the run-up to the Games, and what we'll see afterwards. You also mentioned privatisation. What's the connection there with the Olympics? Well, I mean, the Olympics is really the reason I wanted to write this new chapter of Ground Control, which came out actually in 2009. And then 3 years later, in 2011, I wanted to write this new chapter because it seemed to me that actually the Olympics was really the high point of all the themes that I talked about in Ground Control, which is about the privatisation and control of various parts of the city, this privately owned model of creating parts of the city, which is dependent on borrowing very large amounts of money. It's dependent on huge amounts of debt, which are and then all this money is ploughed into places in the hope that property values will continue to rise. And of course, that was the cycle that worked feverishly well during the boom years. But it's collapsed now. And that's the key point. Although the Olympics is the high point of all of this, actually, the economic rationale for it has completely collapsed. So that's why I wanted to write about this, because it's the sort of ultimate example of this privatised model. It's this huge Westfield Stratford city, private shopping complex with open air private streets and private security guards, and then this Olympic Park, which is largely on that private model as well. The Olympic Village has already been sold off to a consortium led by the Qatari royal family. It will be controlled and owned by them after the Games. The Olympics seem to me to be the absolute high point of this model, and yet in a context where the economics of it had totally fallen apart.
Yeah, exactly. The argument for use of CCTV is to cut crime and make people feel safe. But what are the psychological effects surveillance and security have on people?
Well, again, there's two parts to your question here, and I'm going to have to take both of them separately.
Sure.
Because this issue about CCTV cutting crime, CCTV doesn't cut crime. And actually, if you talk to lots and lots of senior people in the police, they will be the first to say CCTV does not reduce crime. CCTV is often very popular and people often want it. And the argument that people will put forward in favour of the use of CCTV is that it makes people feel safer. But very few people will say that it actually cuts crime, because it doesn't. People, well, when I say very few people will say, they will say, people believe it erroneously. CCTV doesn't cut crime, but there is a perception that it makes people feel safer. I think that perception is really mistaken. And given the huge amount of resources we put into CCTV, 2/3 of the Home Office budget on crime prevention. There is no evidence actually to say that CCTV does make people feel safer. So to get on to what is the impact of CCTV on the way we feel about fear of crime and the environment within which we live. Well, one of the key arguments of ground control is that this kind of high security environment actually creates this culture of fear and paranoia and makes us in fact feel more scared, and it actually undermines that collective sense of solidarity that strangers have unconsciously almost with each other. When you walk through the streets of the city, these sort of unconscious interactions which just happen all the time, and it's those eyes on the street of everybody together which is what makes places safe, and it's what makes people feel safe. And actually all these external controls are chipping away at that and undermining that. So I would say CCTV actually not only makes us feel more scared, actually it could in fact be responsible for greater crimes by actually undermining that sense of solidarity. And the real issue here is that there's so little research done on this, and we really need to start, you know, really commissioning some proper research into this issue, because it's just so much misinformation on this topic.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. Who are the people behind urban planning, and what are the motives?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there is this perception, probably a hangover from the 1950s and the 1960s, when planning was, in fact, a very powerful profession, discipline in this country. There's this perception that planners are still quite influential and powerful, and urban planning is actually responsible for the city environment that we've been creating. And again, this is an erroneous perception. Really, the last 15 years or so, the last generation largely, I would say, late sort of the high point of Thatcherism post 1989, we've seen what's called property-led regeneration. And this property-led regeneration, really, it's the property industry which is very much responsible for this concept of regeneration. And it's this model which is based on borrowing huge amounts of money in the hope that property values will continue to rise. And that's what's created this picture in this country, where we have such high land values and property prices. So, you know, I would say that really it's property developers who are very much responsible for this. On top of that picture, I would say it's the unregulated environment in which so much of the private sector has operated since the mid-80s and Big Bang, which deregulated the financial services industry. Similarly, unregulated environment in property as well. So actually, I'd say while the property development industry is very much at the centre, it's policymakers who've created an environment where the free market really, you know, is allowed to pretty much do whatever it wants in our cities in the name of economic best value. So policy making is very important as well. But if you want to pinpoint a single industry, certainly it's property development.
Yeah. Following on, we live in a time of austerity, and all of our money has been taken from hospitals and libraries and nurseries. Where is this all money for the Olympics coming from?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. It's coming from us. We, the taxpayer, have paid for the Olympics. The whole point of this model, which I've been describing, this property-led regeneration model where you borrow very large amounts of money in the hope that property prices will continue to rise, that worked during the boom. But, of course, with the financial crisis, it's entirely fallen apart. And private sector developers can't borrow those amounts of money anymore. We've heard enough about how the banks aren't lending, you know, people can't borrow, the construction industry is at its knees, house building is at the all-time lowest level. So how on earth have we built this super expensive Olympic Park? Well, the whole idea was that the property company which was responsible for building the Olympic Village, an Australian property multinational called Lendlease, they were was supposed to raise the finance, borrow, to use the correct terminology, for that. But of course, around 2008, when they were supposed to be doing this, they were unable to raise a penny. So the Olympics were, like the banks, seen as a project which was simply too big to fail. So the government stepped in, and at the same time as we bailed out the banks, we also bailed out the Olympic project. Yeah. And funding for the Olympic project was increased at that point by £5.7 billion, bringing the budget up to this £9.3 billion figure. And according to the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee, the private sector has put up just 2% of the budget for the entire Olympic project. So, yes, the money has come from us, the taxpayer.
Unbelievable, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
but I should also say Lendlease was then employed by the government to manage the project of building the Olympic Village. So they've done fine out of it.
Of course, yeah, of course. I wouldn't be surprised if they go over budget as well, as these things.
Yeah, well, the 9.3 billion figure has now been revised upwards and is, I think, now closer to 11 billion. And that's not accounting for the security budget. So, you know, you are probably looking at around 15 billion pounds.
Oh, blimey. Yeah. Not cheap, is it? London is more and more looking like a playground for the rich. Working class communities seem to be socially cleansed in what's described as regeneration. But many of us know it's gentrification. Is this unique to London, do you think, and the UK? Or is this a pattern re-emerging globally?
It's certainly not unique to London. I would see it as the trickle-down model, what the trickle-down model does. This whole model I've been describing of borrowing lots of money, pulling in lots of investment into a place, it began in Docklands in the late 80s. And it was justified on the basis that bringing all this finance into one of the poorest areas of the country, actually it would, the wealth created would trickle down to the poorest parts which need it the most. And of course we know that absolutely failed to happen in Docklands, and it has failed to happen in every other part of the country since then. So, I mean, certainly model not limited to London. You know, you look at large cities like Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle, Edinburgh, every British city has got developments which are based on this sort of model. It's very much a phenomenon which is the US is very familiar with as well, and Europe to perhaps a slightly lesser extent, because they simply have more regulation and they have more planning. But, you know, certainly I would say it's a model which is familiar to Western economies around the world. I wouldn't want to talk too much about contexts that I personally know very little about.
Yeah. Yep. Next question. Over the Olympic period, we're getting more accustomed to more... more accustomed to more police and military on the streets and a general militarisation in security. What are your opinions on the future on policing and the legacy the Olympics will leave behind?
Yeah, I mean, we referred to this earlier, really, didn't we, with the G4S story. I think it's a really mixed picture because of what has happened with G4S. Certainly what the legacy was supposed to be, the security legacy was supposed to be, was that it was going to be this great showcase for the private security industry to really show what it could do and to show that on a global stage. And, you know, I mean, it couldn't really have played out any worse for G4S. So, I mean, I think that's come at a very interesting time because we've heard all the stories recently about the contracting out of more and more parts of the police, and companies like G4S were going to take up a very big slice of that. So, I mean, you know, there's been some discussion now of actually banning G4S from taking up those contracts. But really, of course, we've got to shift the debate onto a much wider terrain and say, actually, you know, are private security firms the right people to be running the police service? And I think the sort of shambles we've seen here with this, and it's not the first time that this company has got itself into trouble, although it's certainly the most prominent, you know, has just shown that no, actually they're not, you know, and we don't want this model of privatizing out every aspect of our public services. So, you know, I hope this is going to act as a wake-up call. So actually I think what has happened is has been unexpectedly a very good thing. And I'm quite hopeful that we'll have a proper debate about policing as a result of it. I'm sure that there are people in the police who are not unhappy as well with the way it's panned out.
Last year saw the birth of the Occupy movement worldwide, which is based on the idea of taking back space, liberating it, if you like. The protest could be seen as a result of the increase of privatisation and enclosure of public space. Where do you see the future in reclaiming of public space for public use?
Well, I think there's two parts to that question. Where's the future in terms of where are various activist groups taking it? And, I mean, there's always a sort of two-way relationship with these things. Where's the future in terms of where we're heading economically? Let's take the latter point first. Where are we heading economically? I mean, when I first wrote Ground Control, when I first had the idea for it, I thought, really, the only thing I can do is highlight this trend towards these very large-scale, privately owned places, these undemocratic spaces which are being created all over the city. I can just show what's happening, you know, how the streets beneath us are being silently privatised, but there's nothing we can really do about it. Just having a debate about it might help. And then, of course, halfway through writing the book, we had the financial collapse. So actually that seemed to me to open up this alternative space. And I ended the book on quite a positive note, saying, well, you know, really now the era of Tina, that famous Thatcherite mantra, there is no alternative. Now that really is over and we're going to have to look at real alternatives. Now that hasn't really happened to any great degree yet. But what we have seen is that most of these large-scale private estates have just come to a halt. So, OK, we've got Westfield's Stratford City built here for the Olympics. But in Bradford, Westfield were also supposed to be building this very large, open-air, privately-owned shopping mall. And it's just a huge 23-acre hole in the ground. And it's the same all around the country, in Edinburgh, in Leeds, in Preston, in cities outside London. There's still a little bit of development going on in London, particularly when funded by the Qatari royal family, such as the Shard, who have also bought the Olympic Village. But outside London, this model has just come to an end. So I think we are going to start looking at alternatives because there's simply no option. So from that point of view, I think we will start looking at different ways of doing things. But again, policymakers remain really reluctant to do that. They just are still just clamouring for a return to business as usual, even though that, you know, self-evidently is not going to happen. You know, it's about as likely as Greece is to repay its debts. You know, we've got to just sort of look at a new way of doing things. But let's take the first part of your question, which is, you know, how do I think activists are going to, you know, reclaim public space? And that's happening, obviously, at the same time as, you know, the economic picture is changing and those things, you know, connect with each other symbiotically. Well, I mean, I don't think there's ever been more interest, in my experience, in this whole phenomenon of the impact of private space. So on the day, was it that the Shard was opened or around that time, somebody scaled up the Shard just to show that, you know, he could. And Channel 4 ran this... excuse me, I've got a bad cough.
Yeah.
Channel 4 ran this piece on, you know, why have you done this, talking to this guy. And he was saying, well, you know, it seems to me that I've got to do things like that just to sort of start to reclaim the space. So there's all sorts of interventions going on and there's all sorts of groups who are now sort of aware of this issue. I mean, obviously, the group which highlighted the most clearly what the impact of the privatisation of public spaces is Occupy, because you know, why were they on the steps of St Paul's Cathedral? They'd never intended to camp on the steps of St Paul's Cathedral. They'd wanted to occupy the London Stock Exchange. They were called Occupy London Stock Exchange, but of course they couldn't occupy the London Stock Exchange because it's in privately owned Paternoster Square, and in fact the only space in the entire city of London, the only sizable public space, is that area around St Paul's Cathedral, because the rest of the city has now morphed into a series of these privately owned estates. So, you know, that was one of the real benefits, actually, of Occupy, highlighting this issue of what the privatisation of public space means. I mean, you know, there is a whole host of behaviours that aren't allowed in private space, from cycling, rollerblading, even eating and drinking in some places, to filming, taking photographs. But critically, no political protest. Mm. And that comes to the nub of it. These are not democratic spaces. So, you know, Occupy was very galvanising for, I'm saying was, because I'm not quite sure where they're headed now, which is another very big issue. But what we have seen is that, you know, they were very galvanising for the whole issue. So, yeah, I mean, I feel pretty, you know, positive that I've never seen more interest in this whole area, you know, in all the time that I've been involved with looking at it.
Mm. So what made you want to write Ground Control?
Well, it was one of these things that I sort of stumbled into, actually. It's probably a mix of conscious and unconscious motives, but I mean, I never actually set out to write a book or be a writer. I was quite a committed journalist. That's what I really wanted to do. But then I got quite disillusioned with journalism, and, you know, I felt you couldn't really do very much within the confines of editorial lines, and, you know, lots of the best stories just never get out there. So I started to find journalism frustrating. And I moved away from it to longer pieces of work. I started writing reports for policy organisations and think tanks. I mean, that was the other thing I found frustrating with journalism, this whole emphasis on speed. You know, it's like, how fast is someone? Can they do five stories a day? Well, yeah. You know, who wants to do five stories a day? They're all going to be not very good. Yeah. So, you know, it was a combination of not being able to get really interesting material into the paper, combined with this whole speed thing. You know, I just wanted to work in a sort of longer sort of way and really think about things. So I started working in this different way. And the first person that commissioned me to write a report of this kind had seen a piece I'd written in The Guardian looking at this idea of mixed communities, comparing that with the emergence of this pattern of gated communities and ghettos in the US. And that report questioned whether those really polarised trends were coming over to the UK, and that was back in 2002. And that report just really hit a nerve. You know, it got more coverage on a single day than anything I'd ever done. It was even on the news at 10. You know, I couldn't believe it. I was this sort of little known journalist who wrote this report about gated communities, and suddenly it hit a sort of touch paper. And I thought, okay, well, there's really sort of something going on here. And then I did another report about polarisation in British cities. And then I did another report on the privatisation of public space. And I thought, hang on, I think I've got a book here, you know, and I did.
But people definitely want to hear more about it. Well, that's all, folks. Brace yourselves. This Friday, the 27th of July, the Olympics opening ceremony kicks off. Lucky you if you're getting away. If you're staying, then the Counter Olympic Network will be holding a march the following day on the 28th of July, the Saturday at 12 noon. Assemble at Mile End Park, and then it'll end up in Victoria Park. Their focus is to demonstrate against the corporate games, amongst other things. Look out for the Anti-Olympics paper by Alarm. There are copies at Freedom Bookshop in Allgate East and Houseman in King's Cross, or alternatively go to alarm.org to read it online. Thank you so much, Anna Minton, coming on your amazing on the show to explain to us how it's not just a game. Go to the Circle Day Facebook page for updates, and don't forget the website where you can listen to past shows, www.thecircleday.com. Next week will be Distant an Island broadcasting for the Circle Day. Till next week, turn on, tune in, and kick off.
Through the best of times, through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36? We went our separate ways. You fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you're done pairing your baby. What's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers. They call it class.